Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Put a spring in your step and fresh looks in your home, in-store or online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. 51551 is our text number. It was 100 days exactly before February the 1st that we got our first call about the deposit return scheme, you know, the beverage bottles and cans. Now, every one of them has a tax on it of 15 cent or 25 cent. And the 100 days call beforehand it came in was people wondering what it was all about, especially shopkeepers. Well, Kieran, by the way, I'll be talking to somebody later on the programme, who travelled 1,000 kilometres to bring back the two plastic bottles. Two bottles of water she bought, and she paid $6.50, but she said nearly killed her. But she travelled 1,000 kilometres eventually to get her 25 cent back on each bottle, believe it or not. But Kieran Foley of Deposit Return, it's a government, well, a government quango, for want of a better word. It's enforceable there, the law. He said today, talking to Claire, that last Sunday was a fantastic day because 2 million beverage bottles and cans were returned. It was our best day ever by a long shot. Well, work out the math. 5 million beverage bottles and cans are sold every day. Every single one of them now has to have the tax on it of 15 or 25 cents. That's why people are paying more for bottled water and cans of Coke and cans of beer than they ever were. The 5 million of them are sold every day. Remember, the tax is put on by this, is collected by the supplier or the wholesaler if it comes in from a different country. So the supplier gives that money to Deposit Return. They don't keep it. So we had calls, people saying, oh, the little shopkeeper out by, he's no facility to take the bottles back. Therefore, he or she is getting the deposit. They are not. They are paying the deposit before they pass it on to you. It's the deposit return scheme that will get the unused and the unreturned bottles and cans, i.e. money. So they're saying the best day ever so far was 2 million last Sunday. 5 million are sold on average every day. That's 3 million on their best day, which are not returned on average. Multiply that over the year. By the way, that's 600,000 a day of non-collected deposits that people have paid. And over the year, return, this new government organisation, they will collect on that basis 219 million of unredeemed deposits. They get every 25 or 15 cents you pay, if you don't bring back the bottle, it goes back to not your little shopkeeper, it goes back to the organisation set up to run the scheme. So it goes back into their coffers. 219 million on average they will get each year. Last Sunday they got, on their best day ever, they got €600,000 effectively back into their coffers. We'll be talking to that caller again, as we have been doing later on in the programme. Gemma, good afternoon. Air rage won't abate. What happened?
Hi, Joe. Well, my mum passed away in June last year, and about a week after she passed away, we got the bill in, which I went and paid. €20. She had a little mobile, it was €20 every month.
Okay.
And, of course, I didn't realise that you're paying in advance all the time, so we were €20 in credit.
Well done. Yeah.
Yeah. So, the next month then, we just kept getting an invoice in, if you call it, a statement, I suppose, saying she was in credit.
Okay.
So I emailed them. I explained that she'd passed away. They sent me a bereavement form. I filled that in. They sent me a reply email saying, sorry for your loss. Thanks for returning the form. I think I have that now about three times.
Okay, so your point is, Gemma, that keeps you're not fighting to get the €53 back at this stage. You just want to stop them wasting everyone's time.
I don't want the letter coming in. Too upsetting.
Yeah.
So every month comes in with my mum's name and address on it, despite numerous emails, phone calls to lovely people, all assuring me, no, it'll never happen again. But yes, I got one in last week.
Okay. And what did it... Where, God rest your mother, but where will the credit go?
Well, I did ask them if they could send it to me as executor of a will, but it was so complicated, I said, what?
Yeah.
Let's forget about that. Write it off. Keep it. Please just don't send any more letters.
Not being facetious, but your mother, God rest her, I'm sure is above in heaven. What she can do with the 53 euro from air?
No, I don't
there.
Know what she'll do with the 53 either, Joe.
She's up in the sky. And you say there's simply no way of stopping them. That's the problem.
No
matter what you
I've
do.
Spoken to about 6 different people now that all assure me, no, it'll never happen again. We're very sorry.
But it
definitely won't come next month, and it comes again.
Okay, Jim. Well, God rest your mother. But it's another interesting angle on air. Michaela Hillary, again, unfortunately, someone passed away. What happened, Michaela?
Hi, Joe. Well, my husband passed away last year in March. And in April or the early June, I again filled out a bereavement form and informed AIR and informed them that I wouldn't be keeping on my husband's package. But I did say, would they contact me maybe to discuss a different package for my own son? And I didn't hear anything back from them. And I phoned, and then they said someone would contact me back, and that went on for a while. And then I was paying his bill, which was quite large, so I contacted them and said, look, I'll give you to this Friday if you don't contact me back. And I got a young guy on the phone, and he said, well, my personal opinion, I feel the onus is on you to phone every day. So after that, I didn't contact them again. I went with a different provider. And so anyway, this year... in February, I got a letter from Stubbs Gazette for the amount of 867 euros in my name, not my husband's name, in my name. So I contacted them and I spoke to a guy and I said, I've never given permission to have the account changed to my name.
Yeah.
I don't have any debt with them. I've never used any of their services since last June.
Yeah.
And so he told me to contact them. He could see from his paperwork that there had been no permission for an account form changeover.
Okay.
And so he said, will you contact them back, but email them, which I did. And then that went on for several. They acknowledged the email, and then someone did contact me and said they were looking into it. Mm-hmm. And that went on for a couple of weeks. And then finally, on the day of his anniversary, a girl phoned and said she was pleased to inform me that my case file was now closed and no further action would be taken. And I remember just having, before she got off the phone, because she was quick to do so, I said, this isn't personal, but I said, the way you've handled this, I said, anyone can make a mistake, be made. But the stress of suddenly sending someone a letter for that amount through the post, and no acknowledgement of your mistake. I said, you've made a mistake, but I said, you're not apologetic about it. It's almost like you've done me a favor by, closing the file. I just felt that they dealt with this in a horrendous way. And I don't think they were apologetic.
And yesterday, Michaela, and indeed the day before, we heard a number of people say, when I rang up about my husband's bill or my partner's bill, they said, no, we can't deal with you. We can only deal with the account holder. They've actually put you in Stubbs Gazette, so to speak.
No, it's come in my name.
And by the way, what
she said was that my bereavement form went to the wrong department. That was her explanation for the error they made. That my bereavement, but when I charged my husband's phone up, they'd been billing him monthly. So although the debt was accruing under his phone number and his email, the actual bill came out in my name.
Where do you stand now? You don't. I don't know how.
Well, I
agree. I previously advised people: would you not write to them? Would you not send a registered letter? And we're discovering over the last few days that people who took that advice didn't get anywhere either. The registered letter wasn't even acknowledged, which it should be.
I can only assume now that because she said they've dealt with it, it was their error, it went to the wrong department. I can only assume that there is no further action to be taken against me because it's their error. I'm hoping so. I do actually probably need to contact Stubbs Gazette and find out for sure.
But it's not nice getting a letter from Stubbs Gazette. Oh, and Eyre know that.
Yeah. And there'd be no previous correspondence to the House. This just came out in February this year. That just arrived on the doorstep.
As I said yesterday, this all reliance by Eyre and Stubbs Gazette for minor infractions, alleged minor infractions. Yesterday, by the way, McKeddie, you might have heard, I read out some a member of staff sent us in the round robin email. Oliver Looms, CEO of Eyre, sent round. And among other things, he said, well, he had a go with us, I suppose. He said, the majority of media coverage has centred on aspects not directly related to details of the case. Comreg made serious and incorrect allegations against Eyre. OK, and then he goes on to say this doesn't make for, he was talking about we've improved significantly. There's no evidence of that. And I'm sure there is on your screen, but in a lot of our listeners' lives, there isn't. However, that doesn't make for a great headline. The portrayal of these events in the media has been disappointing. Now, Comreg have sent us back a rocket of a statement saying Eyre. You did not raise objections to the facts underlying any of the cases before the court. During the course of the hearing, this is from Comreg, basically telling Oliver, you're wrong, and being diplomatic. During the course of the hearing, reference was made to an onboarding manual used by Eyre for new customer service agents. This manual was provided to Comreg by Eyre in the course of a formal investigation into Eyre's complaints, handling processes and procedures. It formed part of the book of disclosure in the prosecution, i.e. Eyre would have been aware of it before the court case. And then they just finish with this stinger from Comreg. Eyre was convicted in each of the 10 cases before the court. So they're throwing Mr. Loom's statement into the bin, saying it's wrong. They knew all this, and it's no point saying afterwards that it was. And by the way, in Mr. Loom's statement, and I said it yesterday, he baldly states that Comreg made serious and incorrect allegations, but he doesn't say how they were incorrect. He doesn't say how the... He does go on to say the language used by Eyre might have been a little bit ambiguous, to say the least. Michaela, we'll keep in touch. John Moore. John, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
What happened?
Well, mine goes back a bit now. It was 2015, 2016, when I had a run-in with Eyre over my account. I changed provider.
Yeah, as a lot of people do.
Yeah, and I got my letter of notice of termination, which was the 5th of January in 2016. So that's your notice that they'll switch off your supply and all of that. I'd switched over. The number had been ported over to the new company. Everything was grand. Then I started getting in a bill for $27.83 from Eyre. And I was trying to figure out what the hell is that for. I sorted everything out. The account was paid in full.
Okay.
So I started ringing in then to their... the free phone number, and I rang in 9 times, spoke to 9 different people, and on each occasion I was told, sorry John, that's going to be sorted out, don't worry about it, you won't get it again. But it kept coming out, so I said, oh to hell with it, I'm not going to bother me Barney anymore with that, I've done enough, I've done everything I can. And the next thing was then I on my text to my phone.
Your line disappeared there, John. But basically what Eyre did again, they sent it to a, they sent this bill of €27, I don't know what it was at that stage, but it wasn't far off 27. Yeah. They sent it to a debt collection company that came after you.
A debt collection company that came after me, and they were texting me and phoning me and all that type of thing. Now, I chose to ignore them. I said, I got back onto Eyre. I said, listen, I never owed anyone any money.
Yeah.
I said, this is your problem, not my problem. So I wrote out a letter of explanation, detailed everything to them, and I sent it in. And then the account was sorted out. So then I decided, I said, what am I going to do here? My data has been given to a debt collecting company.
Yeah.
So I contacted
Comreg or whatever.
Data protection.
Well done.
Yeah, I contacted them and I said in the letter what had happened. So anyway, they said, yeah, we'll take it on. So they took it on and they contacted Eyre. And then I said in my letter to Eric that I demand, first of all, a letter of apology, and also that confirmation that all my data has been taken back from the debt collection company. And I finally got a letter then. I had to write twice looking for it, but I got a letter from her apologising and confirming that all my data had been taken back and that it wouldn't go any further. Unfortunately, the first letter I got wasn't signed.
Okay, and you look for a signature. You sent it back looking for a signature.
I sent it back.
Now, but tell me, John, I want to go back to this debt collection agency.
Yeah.
How often were they contacting you on behalf of AIR for this €27?
Oh, it was a regular thing.
Well, were they ringing you? Were they sending you letters? Were they
ringing me. And I finally got a letter from them then on the 7th of April, 2016. That's when I got the final letter from them. And when I got that, I hit the roof. I said, that's it. I'm going to take action on this. I ignored it because, Jesus, I don't know. Anyone, any money. Okay. What are they contacting me for?
Well, people normally get frightened when they see debt collection agencies, John. That's what they're banking on, pardon the pun.
Yeah.
That's
but
why
I
Stubbs
knew,
Gazette, it's the name. I'm sure there's people in Stubbs are gorgeous. And they're all Aquarians,
but
very gentle people. But it's the name that frightened
me. What annoyed me so much about it, Joe. Yeah, it's what annoyed me so much about it was that my information had been given to these people. Now, I'm of an age where it doesn't really matter to me. I'm not looking for loans. I don't need money from anybody. But if you were a younger person, your name is on that list.
For the rest. Okay, and you might not know how it got there. Okay, John, Brian Morrissey. Brian, you had a positive experience in an AIR shop, which people do have, but you can't pay your bill in an AIR shop, can you?
No,
you can't.
But I'm dealing with AIR right through back to the time that they were called Meteor.
Yeah, what
which is quite a while ago.
I don't know if they were ever called Meteor, but anyway, okay, they might have.
Let's just say the same shop just changed names.
Okay, and you say when you go into the shop, which we had a call about this on Monday, the people in the shop are all Aquarians. They're absolutely gorgeous. They're very pleasant to deal with.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I find that even though, I'm sort of advanced age and they teach you with...
Which is great. But have you ever gone in with a complaint about your bill?
Yes. And they say that the shop were very nice and they say, look, they haven't got the authority to ring on my behalf from the shop.
So they can't...
And they gave me a number to contact.
Okay. But the AIR shop... The AIR shop on the high street, as they call it, it cannot deal with the major problem which many of AIR customers have, and that is difficulties with their bill. And that's what they decided. The shops don't deal with those issues. Sure they don't.
No. Okay. That's only happened on one occasion.
Yeah, but you're saying the people in the shop, whereabouts is that particular shop? In Waterford?
It's Bardenstrand Street in Waterford.
Oh, yeah, the centre there. Well, a big shout-out for the brilliant AIR staff in the centre of Waterford, and well done for giving Brian Morrissey that number. Thanks indeed, Brian. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
AIR Rage continues, and, well, I was going to say unfortunately, but the people are there. Paddy Lyons, Paddy.
Yeah, Joe.
What happened? Let's hope the line is good, Paddy.
Line is good, Joe. I had an AIR email address, okay?
Yeah.
And they put it up to $5.99, and I said, no problem, I'll pay that. And they said, we want to go direct debit. And I said, no, I'll pay it myself, no problem. So I paid it. Then they put up again, and I kept paying it. And then they said, I have to go direct debit. And then they pulled the plug. And so, I left school when the television was black and white, right?
Okay.
So I had folders on it with photographs of my grandfather, Jack Marr, Lord rest him, playing in 1901 in All-Ireland, final for Kilkenny in football, right? I had photographs of me dad from Valinch Island, all in the folders. Lost a whole lot of them. So then I tried to contact them.
And you lost them all?
They pulled the plug, right? So what happened then is, so then you ring them up, and they said, first thing they ask is for your account number. And then you get that number's not recognised. You know?
Okay.
So that was it. So I lost a whole lot, Joe. And I worked for AIR myself, doing the tree work. My brother Thomas and Jared, lot of them worked for the telecom. And they were a brilliant company years ago when it was P&T and telecom and that. But now it's like Green Acres.
That's the place to be. Will you remind people what Green Acres was?
You had to go up the tree, have the power to make the phone call, Joe. Right. Yeah.
It was that Mr. Heaney, Zaza Gabor, Eddie Albert. It was a hapless little village where...
But that's what it's like now, Joe. As I say, like they were great over the years. My dad's time, Lord rest, my brother, God, we go to me out in the trees, and that they were brilliant. You know, way leaves like you're dropping cams. They were a brilliant company. I worked with myself, but now it's just these people. I'd often say to these people, like if they work for themselves, they'd starve. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, if I let someone down, Joe, I wouldn't sleep.
Well, Mr. Loom said they 500 people answering calls, answering complaints.
Yeah,
but he then says there are only 27 complaints are made to Comreg every month. What are the 500 people doing?
Maybe the screen agers, though. You understand me? Glued to the screen, the phone, the kids. Screen agers, they call them, you know.
Yeah. And by the way, people say when they do get through to somebody, though the manual told us different in terms of what the staff were instructed. Yeah. And the judge, remember, asked Air to apologise to their staff. Not just to their customers. Okay, Paddy, God bless you, Paddy.
God bless
and
you
the,
too,
sorry
Joe.
About those photographs are missing, Paddy Lyons.
Cheers,
where's Leona? Leona, good afternoon.
Oh, hi, Joe. How are you?
Good. What happened? You was your aunt.
Yeah, my aunt, Philomena Armstrong, she was with Air and prior companies before that. Never missed a bill or anything, right?
Okay.
91 years of age, chronic COPD, oxygen 24 hours a day, had a personal alarm that she needed a landline for.
Okay.
The landline went down, got in touch with Air about 3 or 4 days later. Now, we did explain how important it was. Lived independently. And when they did come out, we explained she couldn't get to the door. So, like, we would ring a neighbour or her carer. But they just put a note on the door to say that she didn't answer the door. I got in. 15 minutes later, I rang them and asked them, could they get the engineer back? Stressing how important it was, they couldn't get in touch with the engineer. Then I says, well, could you get in touch with the engineer's supervisor? And they said, no, they couldn't. And I says, well, what about the landline? And they just says, well, we'll come tomorrow and see what happens. And if she answers the door, we'll look after her. But that went on for 3 or 4 days.
And nothing?
Nothing. And then they did eventually come out. And then when she ended up going into hospital, we left them, right? And we went with Virgin Media, which were brilliant. So I wanted to cancel her account, but because it was on her name was on the account, they said I'd have to get her to sign it. Unfortunately, at that stage, she was in hospital and she was very, very unwell.
And remind people, you rang Air and said, your aunt, Aunt Philomena.
My cousin did, and then explained.
That when the doorbell rang, it would take her a few minutes to get to the door.
Yes.
And she'd no landline, so you couldn't ring her and say, will you come to the door? Because that was the problem. So, but every time she got to the door, the poor woman, the engineer was gone.
Yeah. And, like, she was on oxygen, she really was, she was very unwell. Now, she lived independently and she was a brilliant woman, but all we wanted was a bit of help. So, when I did ring the guy and he said, no, we can't do anything, I've been honest with you, Joe, I was so upset, I started crying. And they just said they don't have a priority list. And I did, trying to explain to them, this woman lives on her own.
Yeah.
She needs this landline for her personal alarm, but no. And then they wouldn't cancel the account until I went into the hospital and got a doctor to sign it to say that she wouldn't be in the house.
And by the way, Leona, what happened when you started crying?
It just says there's nothing they could do. Absolutely nothing they could do. They couldn't put her on a priority list. Now, I felt foolish, Joe, for crying, but even at my aunt's, she struggled. But so much to breathe, you know what I mean? All he wanted was a little bit of help.
But Leona, even that image... You said of but the poor woman, her phone is gone. She needs her phone back. So you get on to Air. They say we'll send out an engineer. You tell them, just to be clear about this, you tell them, by the way, Philomena lives on her own. She's of an age. She has chronic COPD. So when you knock or ring the bell, will you give her 5, 10, 15 minutes to get to the door?
Yeah.
She will come out. She's not gone out playing hockey. She's in the house.
Exactly. Yes.
And why wouldn't you, with that image, why wouldn't you cry?
Oh, it's just, it was just traumatising. And then I did send them in a form now, they have a contact form through their website. And I sent it in, and I did, being honest with you, a couple of weeks later, I got a phone call from a girl, and she just said that there is no priority list, and I explained my aunt's situation, and I did say to her, well, look, if anybody ever is in given the bonus for coming up with a good idea, maybe you could be the one that could just turn around and say, well, maybe we should have a priority list. Because, like, Electric Ireland, they, and the gas company, they have a vulnerability list, like, you know, for people that maybe would need oxygen or whatever. So, like, my aunt would have been on that list, that if there was a power cut, that she would be looked after. But AIR just don't seem to look after anybody.
Okay, Leona, okay. And as you say to me, I see there in the bottom note, the footnote, that Philomena passed away in January. God rest her anyway.
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
And, Wonderful woman.
And she passed it down to her nieces as well and her family. Well done, Leona. Anne Lone, Anne, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
Okay, what happened with AIR?
Well, this is going back to 2018. I was just looking up my records and I rang in to tell people that for some people there is a way out of this. Basically, I changed provider because AIR were offering a good package.
Okay.
They sent the technician along to change the broadband modem on, say, Friday. The guy never turned up, so I said, this is it. I had been with Telecom Éireann like years before. And they had given me the runaround on several occasions.
Okay.
I said, I'm not going back to AIR at all. No way. So I rang up and I cancelled. I said, listen, I'm cancelling. I'm staying with the provider I'm with. So about a month later, I got a bill. And then a month later, I got a bill. The bills kept coming. I kept ringing in saying, I'm not a customer. I'm not a customer. They weren't listening. So eventually, I was coming out of a meeting one day and it was the missed call. When I rang the number, they said they were from Cabot Finance.
Oh, hello. Well, they're a reputable company. They're debt collection as well, do they?
Yeah. Okay. I didn't know who they were.
Yeah, that's fine.
I thought maybe somebody had left me some money in their will or something. I didn't know. But anyway, I rang them back and I said, they said, we're a debt collection. And I said, well, I've paid all my bills. I'm happy enough to be able to say that. And they said, well, there's one bill where you haven't paid. And I said, and who is that for? And they said, well, we can't give you those details until you give us your name, address, and date of birth.
Okay.
And I said, well, I don't know who you are. You could be Jack the Ripper for all I know. I'm not giving you those details. So I got home anyway, and I had a little think about it, and I thought, there was a letter from Cabot on the doorstep, coincidentally, that day. And then I realised that, well, AIR had given them personal information about me that they shouldn't have. So I got onto Comreg. By the way, I had been onto Comreg quite a few times. They were not any help at all, I'm afraid to say.
Okay.
So I thought about the personal details from AIR to Cabot, and I said, I'll go the GDPR route. Well, GDPR had just been brought in May. And so GDPR, again, they couldn't grasp the fact that actually I was not a customer of AIR. They kept going, well, you know, but I stuck with it, and I stuck with my demands, and my demands are simple. I wanted a letter of apology from AIR for all the trouble they had given me. I wanted a guarantee that my credit rating was not impacted by all of this messing around, and I also wanted €500 for a charity of my choice.
Okay.
Now, it took, eventually I got it. They offered 100 and I stuck to my gun. So they know they're in the wrong. But
so AIR passed on incorrect information to a finance company called Cabot.
Well,
they admitted that you weren't in debt. And as a goodwill gesture, they offered you 100 and you said no, for charity, by the way. And you said no, I want 500.
Yeah.
By the way, did they? Yeah. Okay. To a charity of your choice.
They sent me a check for 500, which I split between Alice Leahy and the RNLI.
Well, you can't do better than that. You can't do better than that in terms of charity. But I think they should have sent you a €500 voucher to split between Super Value and Dunnes for yourself for all the hassle. Seriously. Seriously.
I was sort of sorry I didn't stick for a bit more,
Well done.
But there is a way.
Now, we've been on to Stubbs. I just hope I don't get a letter from them. We've been on to Stubbs, and we've asked them all those questions. Like, how are you getting this information from AIR? A lot of the people that that are in Stubbs, according to our calls, are saying we should not be getting letters from Stubbs. We should not be getting letters from Stubbs because we're contesting the amount that, usually a very small amount, that AIR say we owe. Okay, go to Míle Maigre and loan Maeve. Sorry for holding you, Maeve.
Not a problem. I moved from AIR to Vodafone, haven't been with AIR for about 50 years.
Okay.
Because they offered me €60 a month less on two mobiles, okay, and landline and broadband.
Right.
And that was in July last year. So I was getting bills and bills and bills from AIR. And when it hit about €400, I rang them and I said, "Sweetie, I don't owe you any money." And mm-hmm. they said, "Oh, well, this is the bill." So I rang Vodafone in case Vodafone messed up the changeover. Do you get me?
Yeah,
and
of course.
And Vodafone gave me a number for AIR, and when I rang the number, it got me through to accounts. This nice mm-hmm. young man. And I said, "Come here, not, I tell you this. I'm in my late 70s, I'm nearly 80. I won't be paying you that money because I don't owe it to you."
Okay.
And he said, "We'll send a debt collector."
Oh, good luck.
And I said, "Well, if a debt collector comes to me, I'll say exactly the same as I'm saying to you. I won't be paying you any money. Go away and good luck to you." But what I want to say, what I'm fascinated by, is the fear they have engendered in people.
Yeah.
Because about 20 odd years ago, I had a dispute with someone like this again over money I didn't owe.
Okay.
And he put me into Stubbs. And do you know what, Joe? It didn't kill me.
Well done. Okay. Okay.
Do you get me?
Yes.
Do you hear what I'm saying to you? At least that fear they're causing in
so
people.
So you have no fear. And where... the fine was how much? I see 7,000 here.
But this is what I was about to say to you.
Okay.
That's an aberration in the light of the profit that AIRCOM is making. We have a government in this country who should be protecting its citizens.
Maeve, at the moment, how much are AIR saying you owe them, if any?
Well, you see, the problem is, after I decided I wasn't paying it,
yes,
I shredded all their bills, because now it's historical as far as I'm concerned, right?
Okay.
So I shredded everything belonged to AIR. Good luck, 50 years of a relationship gone up the swanny. And every bill that comes in, I don't open it. I put it straight into the shredder, and AIR can do its worst as far as I'm concerned. Because I can see my payments coming out of my bank to Vodafone since July last year. They can take me to court. Judges aren't stupid, although with that judgment you would wonder.
The judgment was fair. A lot of people thought judgment very fair and very straightforward. But the judge is limited. I know people said the fine was very small, but the district court is limited in the amount they can fine. That's why we have higher courts. And you're not worried when the bill comes in and you're making a paper airplane out of it and you're directing it at your shredder, in the corner.
I don't even go to the trouble of opening the envelope.
What they're doing, they say, is legitimate. Let them go through the channels. Okay, Maeve, go to Míle Maigre. Josie Whelan before the break. Josie, what happened?
Hi, Joe.
What happened?
I think this was in 2021. I was a customer of Vodafone, and I got a call one day from an agent from AIR, and he offered a better package, better price.
Yeah.
So I said to him, "I don't know if I can change over. I might still be under contract."
Okay, well said, yeah.
And he said, "No," he said, "I've checked that out for you." He said, "You're free to change over." So he arrived the next day and we signed up and everything. So the 15th of February, I would have been changing over to AIR. So when I said to him then, "Do I need to ring Vodafone?" No, I'll do all that. You don't need to do anything. So when I got my bill then the end of February from Vodafone, which I thought would have been for 2 weeks, it was the month, and I rang them and I said, "Look, I've changed over to AIR." And I said, and he said, no, you couldn't. He said, "You're still under contract for another 6 months."
Okay.
And it was all false information, that the agent. So I rang AIR and I explained everything, and I had the agent's phone number because it was on my phone, and I gave him the name and number, and he said, "I'll be back to you by Friday," he said, "and I'll sort it all out." And from that day to this, 3 years later, I've never heard a word from them. but I was able to cancel my direct debit. So, but I kept getting bills from them, and the amount, in the end, it was nearly 500 euros eventually. And I was never a customer because I was still with Vodafone. And so in the end, then I start getting the emails from Stubbs Gazette.
Ah, oh, for God's sake. Are you serious?
Yeah. And in the end, I rang them and I said, look, I don't owe this money. I said, I explained to them what happened. And she said, the girl said, well, it's your word against theirs.
Oh.
And she said, what will you pay? Will you pay something? And just to get rid of it,
yeah.
And I know I shouldn't have, I said, I'd pay you 50 euros. So she accepted that just to get rid of it. But I know, I said, I'm paying you this, but I do not owe it. Well, she said, that's your word against theirs.
Oh, for God's sake. But you paid them 50 euro.
I paid them 50 euros just to get rid of it, get it off my back.
Now, that's very unfair.
Yeah. But
that's
anyway,
so
that's,
unfair
that
was, now for... For Air to be doing that,
yeah.
And by the
way,
I presume Air got didn't get a red cent out of 50 euros. Cost 50 euros would minister all that nonsense. They
probably
got,
a lot
they
more.
Got
probably,
Stubbs
yeah,
to do.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they just wanted something to close the account. Yeah. Said if you pay something, we'll close it. But as I said, I don't owe it. And like I said, I feel really bad by doing this because I don't owe it. And she said, "Well, that's your word against theirs." So.
Okay, your word against ours, and that's where it's that's where it's come down to over the last. Well, it's been going on such a long time in this program and others. It's Connor in the Irish Times have been doing it as well. It's been going on wherever people raise consumer issues. Sinead as well, and News Talk has been doing it. Okay, Josie, good evening, Maga. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I'm back to the reverse vending machine and the deposit return scheme. Linda Blythe. Linda, good afternoon. What happened?
Hello, Joe. Good afternoon to you. I was in the airport last week, flying to London in and out on the day. I bought two bottles of water from a British chain of news agents in Terminal 1.
Yeah, they're WH Smith.
€6.
Yeah,
€6.50 for the two bottles.
€6.50, fair play.
For two 1 litre bottles.
Okay.
And I left, when I was in the UK, I left a bottle behind me. And I was on the flight on the way home, because it was empty. On the flight on the way home, realised, sure, I'd lost my deposit money on it.
Yeah.
So my second empty bottle came back and I brought it back and I got my deposit return. But I understand they have two return machines, one in each terminal, and I believe it's Boots in Terminal 1. But what is annoying me is that the amount of people that pass through that airport buy their cans and bottles of drinks, consume them down at the gate.
Yeah, of course. So they're waiting.
Some distance away, They're not going to walk back to Boots to get their 15 or 25 cents.
Well, in your case, it was your 50 cent for the two bottles. So you took, how long did that bottle, how far did that bottle travel before it got back to the vending machine, so to speak?
It went to Surrey in the UK and back.
Oh, well done.
Plenty of air miles.
Well, remember the other thing. Well, I will come back because we did Dublin Airport right at the start as well. Dublin Airport said they were not going. The DAA said they were not going to participate in the scheme. They were not going to put the 15 or 25 cent on the can or plastic bottle. What they were going to do now? There used to be a bottle of water in Dublin Airport before this new tax was €1. What you paid, and it was an honesty. You had to pay, but it was an honesty box. And then they got rid of the plastic bottles because of this new tax, and they put in these recyclable cartons. But the same amount of water promptly went up to €2. It doubled the price.
That's right, €2.
But that's the reason they say. Now, remember, in fairness to the Boots and to WH Smith, okay, you say you're going to the departure gates, which are miles away. You can't walk all the distance back with an empty bottle. It kind of defeats the purpose. You'll miss your flight anyway. But remember, WH Smith or Boots, they do not get that money. It is, if your bottle doesn't go back, it's not the shopkeeper, or it's not the supermarket that gets the money. It is the deposit return scheme. They get it. And as I said, if you work out, now, and hopefully they'll be able to contradict me on this, but if you work out their own stats, apparently 5 million beverage bottles and cans are sold in Ireland every day. Last Sunday was the best day ever. Since the scheme came in, and that saw 2 million or two-fifths or 40% returned, right away returned through the system. And obviously they got their deposit back between 15 and 25 cent. Let's average that, say the average is 20 cent. So that means there were 600,000 euro sent back to the Quango last Sunday. And if you work that out on average every day, that means they're going to pull in 219 million in uncollected deposits, and we'll go back to this new organisation. So it is a windfall. It is a windfall. Now, why, as our listener said, 100 days before this was all introduced, why did all the local authorities, all the city councils, why didn't they simply run a really strong campaign for people to return their bottles and plastic bottles and cans, and add, a lot of them have, by the way, an extra receptacle at the bottle bank, one for plastic bottles and one for cans. The price wouldn't have gone up and people would have been doing their civic duty. Michael Kelly, Michael, thanks, Linda. Michael, what happened?
Good afternoon, Joe.
Yeah.
Joe, a quick point I wanted to make, and I think Linda has probably made most of the points I was going to make. The issue of the airport and the shops in the airport taking the money off people for the deposit, and these people are all leaving the country.
But Michael, in fairness, they are not taking the money. They've already paid the money.
No, absolutely,
they
Joe, and I agree with you 100%.
They paid it now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just yeah, I agree with you 100%, yeah. But I'm coming from the point of view that it's the consumer who's paying out the money, and I don't think most consumers really care who it's going to. They want to get their money back. But as Linda said there, like, she had one or two bottles that she had to bring away with her and whatever happens to them. But you extrapolate that out to, say, a family of four or five.
I know.
And all of a sudden, these bottles, that's a lot of money that people are going to have to lose out because of that. And I think it's very unfair. And I think what should happen at the moment is, I think any of the airports in the country, and probably some of the ferry ports, should be made return-free areas. There should be no deposit collector of anybody buying any bottles in any of the airports. That should be brought in immediately, and that could be very, very simply done, I'm saying, if they wanted to do it.
They'll say it's bureaucratically impossible to exempt some areas.
Of course it will, of course. But if you're selling stuff airside, if you're selling bottles airside in Dublin Airport, none of the people that are buying them are going to be able to bring them back, and I think it's very unfair on a basic level for people.
Well, you see, but on the other hand, they do go back because people do dispose of them, and all I'm sure DAA would do this, but they can't get back the money because they never got they didn't get it. What the DAA might do is leave receptacles for people just to get rid of their plastic bottles, which they do. But remember, every bottle you get rid of without going back into the system, you're giving the 25 to 15 or 25 cent on your bottle to the state, effectively.
Absolutely. That is what's happening. So instead of doing that, just let them stop taking the money off the customer who are buying us at the moment. Most of these companies will always go for the easy
option. Are you saying abandon the whole scheme?
No, only abandon it in airports and ferry ports.
Well, why not abandon?
Nowhere else.
Yeah, but why not abandon the whole scheme and start a scheme to encourage councils and people to return? In other words, you wouldn't be paying 6.50 for two bottles of water. You'd be paying 6 euro, and even that's expensive. But that's Dublin Airport. But everyone would be paying less. Like, not everyone, when they go in to buy six bottles of water or whatever for the week because they can't drink the water coming out of the tap. Not everyone can afford that.
No, I agree with you, Joe, but I'm sticking to the point of just the airports and the transit hubs, nothing else. I think that it will be far easier for them to do that, because you've got to remember, every single person that's buying a bottle of water in an airport is after security. They're all airside.
Yeah, but remember,
the ordinary public are not walking down to buy them.
But Michael, you want to make an exemption for what is an infinitesimal amount compared to the 5 million beverage bottles and cans that are sold in Ireland daily. Think about that. Well, that's nearly two billion. It's 1.7 billion a year.
Correct, Joe. But they've brought that system in, and that is never going to be changed. Once it's in, that won't be changed. I think it's far easier to look after the travelling public.
And they brought in the water charges and they ran. And maybe that was a mistake as well. But they brought, like, there is a way around this. We were brilliant. We are brilliant as a nation. We're better than any of the countries, our neighbours even. We are brilliant at recycling glass. And people do it for, they go around or they put it in the shopping trolley or whatever when they're going back. We're brilliant at recycling glass. We were given green bins to recycle our plastic bottles and cans. And people were doing it. And now we're told we weren't good enough at that. So they brought in this incredibly expensive, incredibly complicated scheme. And incredibly expensive, primarily for the hard-pressed punter. Geraldine Kelly, no relation. Good to meet him, Margaret Michael. But the same point, Geraldine. I don't know how many times we can make the same point. Go ahead, Geraldine. Exactly.
Hello, Joe. Yeah, I was going through Dublin Airport in February and I noticed that I couldn't see anywhere to reverse vent the bottles. Now, I was taking mine out of the country to my daughter, so they never came back. But I did email DAA and they said that they were looking into it
at that
stage. And I thought, February, everybody else is up and running. We were
covering this because we noted it when we got the first call 100 days before the first, last October, we were covering this with questions, like that. Now, in fairness, Geraldine, have you brought bottles or beverage bottles or cans back to the machines near your home?
No, I haven't actually had anything to bring back so far.
Okay, and what did you do with them before the new world?
Well, I always put them in my green bin.
Yeah, well, that's what we thought they were for. Okay, Geraldine, good to meet you, Margaret. Joe at rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie. Stephen Crowther, I mentioned today, actually, talking to Louise, that yesterday was the 66th anniversary of the death of our greatest lyrical soprano ever. She died in 1958, Margaret Bourke Sheridan. And I was wondering where her grave was. You know where her grave is, Stephen.
Yes, it's in Glasnevin Cemetery, and it's just across the path from the grave of Eamon de Valera.
Oh, and so it's well kept.
Oh, it is, yeah. Well, I mean, a friend of hers left a gift in perpetuity for its maintenance.
Oh, wow. And how do you know that, Stephen?
It's in Anne Chambers' biography, La Sheridan Adorable Diva.
Well done. And are you a fan?
I'm interested in opera and opera singers, and I love a good operatic voice. So,
for people who didn't know Margaret Bourke Sheridan, how? Because Puccini said she had a tear in her voice. She was she as brilliant as people now believe her to be?
Yeah, well, she had a short but brilliant career. She was discovered because she was orphaned and she was living in the convent in Weston Row. Uh-huh. And then she went over to, or she's a good singer, she went over to London, and Marconi discovered her through the various house parties she would have been singing at. And he sent her to Rome.
Wow.
And then in 1918, one of the lead singers in the Rome Opera came ill, and she was suddenly roped in to sing Mimi in La Boheme in 1918.
Okay.
And she was a big sensation. Although her teacher thought she wasn't ready yet, her technique wasn't refined. Okay.
And when you
and
say,
from that, yeah.
No, continue, Stephen. You're brilliant. You're making.
So just that, and ultimately that, I suppose. Well, she has a brilliant career, but then about 1930-31. She suddenly lost confidence in her voice, and that effectively her career ended then.
Ah, and we've no idea what happened in 1931, Stephen. Why?
Well, I said something happened that she lost confidence in her voice. Although later recordings show that she still had plenty of voice, but essentially her stage career, her glittering career in Covent Garden and Milan, ended there.
Okay, is that a mystery why it ended?
I'm not sure what the being part of it was. I don't think she ever fully developed the technique at the beginning, and so she kind of wore herself out. But whether there are other things as well, I don't know. But okay.
Okay. Well, Stephen, I mentioned the grave, and you mentioned the person inadvertently, Stephen, and well done. The person who tells us she visited the grave yesterday, and that was Anne Chambers. Thank you, Stephen. Stephen Crowder. Hey, Stephen, stay on the line. You might want to ask Anne a few questions. Anne is the biographer and a historian as well of Margaret Bourkshire. Did you visit the grave yesterday, Anne?
I did, Joe, and I usually leave my little bunch of flowers because, a lot of women I've written about in the past, our great diva tends to be ignored by our music authorities here. And every anniversary, I try and do something with her because I have inherited all her operatic and personal memorabilia, which I got when I was researching the biography in 1989.
And just tell us about the visit to Glasnevin yesterday. Was there any sign of anyone else being at the grave?
No.
Does she have any living relatives?
Well, the book, when it came out, did bring some relatives. There was a family dispute in her early days in Castlebar. Well, to go back, really, I'm from Castlebar, and I grew up from my father, who was a great fan of Margaret Bourkshire. And when I was listening to the Beatles, you know, he'd say, why don't you listen to your... and I ended up writing her biography, and it took a long time. I had to spend 6 months following in her footsteps around Italy and, of course, at Covent Garden and Monte Carlo and places like that. But what I found was... why we here in Ireland tend to ignore. She is both beloved and held in such high reverence in operatic circles in Italy, from La Scala to the San Carlo to Turin. All these places have records of her. But what is most important is her own, as a biographer, as you said at your introduction, you know, Puccini, who actually trained her himself for the role of Manon and Manonesco, did say that Margherita sings with a tear in her voice. And as her biographer, I set out to find where did that tear come from and how it affected her operatic performances and her personal life, which was interested in, was quite sad, really.
And was she, Stephen alluded there to the fact, she was born in Castlebar, as you say. How did she end up in Dublin at Westland Row?
She became an orphan at 11 years of age. Ah. She went to the same school I went to, Convent of Mercy in Castlebar.
Okay.
And there was a family, dispute, really. And her father's will allowed her to be educated in Eccles Street, Dominican College in Eccles Street. And, you know, when the other children went home for their school holidays and their summer holidays, she simply had nowhere to go. And it made sense of a later comment she made to a friend, there's no place like home when you haven't got one.
So it was
Eccles. You know, that air of impermanency and having no home, she never knew a home again from the year in 1911 that she left Castlebar until her death. She went from one patron to another, one hotel room to another, one rented accommodation to another, and she had this air, and if you listen to her voice you will hear that sense of impermanency, loneliness and sadness, and that's what brought Puccini to come to hear, which she was called this foreign butterfly who was singing in the Dal Verme Theatre in Milan, and he came there and he just really, as you will possibly hear now in her beautiful voice, the expressiveness was unique.
Thank you.
See, there's the voice. Stephen Crowther, describe that voice to me.
It's just a very sweet and expressive. I mean, I don't know, I'm not don't know the finer points of opera technique, but it's just, it's very pleasant to listen to, and
sure
you get the
is.
Emotion of this, of that thing from Tosca.
And you know where it's from? You know where that piece is from?
It's from Tosca.
Butterfly.
It was a butterfly, sorry.
Butterfly, okay.
Butterfly.
Oh, my okay.
But you know, Joe, just not to cut across you there, but you know, Puccini himself said, I interviewed Renata Tebaldi, whom people in opera will know was the great rival to Callas, and she told me that it was to Sheridan's recordings of all the Puccini works that she herself was trained.
Wow.
You know, it wasn't to some other Italian.
Yeah.
It was to an Irish soprano, Margot Burke Sheridan, whom Tebaldi. And she told me she knew Puccini's daughter, and Puccini's daughter had told her that her father considered Margot Burke Sheridan the greatest butterfly of all.
Okay, now
she brought something extra, and she was the first one actually to do the full electrical recording of the entire butterfly for HMV.
Magic, magic. Mm. And Anne, Stephen alluded to it there, was it the early 1930s? What happened to Margot Burke Sheridan?
Margot Burke Sheridan, it happened to Margot Burke Sheridan like it happens to a lot, like it happened to Callas. She really lost her technique. She had a dramatic, if I was writing a screenplay for Margot Burke Sheridan's life, people would say melodramatic nonsense. She had a dramatic entry into opera in the Rome Opera House. And her technique had not been finally put on a sound footing. But because she got that in 1918, how could she turn it down, a young girl in Italy, to go to one of the prized opera houses in the country? Now, that came against her. And also, she did have an operation on her throat in the late 1930s, and it had to be repeated. And secondly, an affair in name only, anyway, that she was having. The person she liked very, very much sadly died. So a combination of all of these things,
but
and I have all her operatic and personal memorabilia here in my home. And, you know, you can see from the medical, the letters from various medical people whom she attended at that time. So we know now why she
and
couldn't sing
I
anymore.
I was reading another piece which about Breed Mann or Breed Nahuna, and did she not say that, was her story going around at the time that this doomed love affair, that her lover died by suicide?
No, that's straight off the stage of La Scala. No,
okay.
She didn't. She got involved with somebody who was previously engaged, let's say, and at that time, and as she said herself, she couldn't really.
Did she ever?
A girl who had been reared in the convent, she couldn't really go through.
Where did she live in Dublin in Ireland when she came back? Castlebar.
Well, Margaret Burke Sheridan, from the day she left Castlebar, went from one patron to another, and her last patron was very, very interesting. She went to America. I have all her requests here from the Rome, from the Chicago Opera, from the New York Metropolitan, and she would never go to America until the 1950s, and she went as an advisor there for opera, and she met the great Ruth Houghton Axe, who indeed put her grave in perpetual care in Glasnevin Cemetery. And Ruth Houghton Axe was an extremely wealthy patron of Sheridan, and kept her in the Shelburne Hotel during the last few years of her life, and when she died from breast cancer in 1958.
And she, which was the anniversary was yesterday, and she lived in the Shelbourne Hotel to her death?
No, she had a rented accommodation in Fitzwilliam Street first, and then when
around
she
the
got
corner,
ill,
yeah.
on her return, her last great patron, Ruth Houghton Axe, put her in the more salubrious surroundings of the Shelburne, where she was well remembered. Indeed, I remember interviewing the concierge there and a few of the porters who remembered her. She was be quite difficult too, you know. She was in the prima donna status.
And Anne, before the break, how did you inherit, so to speak, 40 boxes of memorabilia, which is incredible.
It is. And I'm looking as I speak for either in Castlebar, her hometown, or maybe some museum or place to put them properly. They were entrusted to me. Now, I did collect a lot myself initially. Well, I interviewed 40 people initially who actually knew and remembered Margaret Burke Sheridan and had photos and all kinds of things. But the main collection came from a fellow Mayo man, and that was the late Garrick Brown.
Ah.
And Gar Brown entrusted to me all this collection, and I will repay his trust to ensure that sometime when an appropriate place comes available, that they will go on permanent display. I have displayed them myself in Castlebar and in Dublin on numerous occasions, but sadly nobody has taken up my offer.
Okay, stay with us, Anne Chen. This is fascinating, Anne, and indeed Stephen. Back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Pat Wallace is the former director of the National Museum. Pat, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
Were you aware that this memorabilia existed? 40 boxes of first-hand memorabilia belonged to Margaret Burke Sheridan.
No, I wasn't, and I'm positively astonished, as it were, but it doesn't surprise me that Anne has been entrusted to that, because Anne is an outstanding scholar, has done so many books. And I love the connection with Garrick de Brun, because I knew Garrick very well, and I didn't realise this was one of his little treasures. No, I'm long out of the Nash Museum.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, no, my sense of this is that it's mainly paper records, and I would, if I were Anne, I would be getting on to Audrey Whitty, the brilliant, and generous director of the National Library.
Okay.
I suspect that Audrey would grab this with both hands, and maybe the physical side of the memorabilia, say if they're performance frocks and gowns and other things, I can only imagine what they are, that they would go to the National Museum. There is a very good link with Castlebar. The National Museum has a very, very excellent branch in Castlebar. So that's a very happy coincidence that maybe the physical memorabilia of this collection, this wonderful collection, obviously, I haven't seen it, but that would finish up maybe in the possession of the state in Castlebar. From time to time, then they could loan it out to other institutions capable of taking. Don't forget, we missed out on the McCormick collection.
We did,
and I was very sad over that, because I had displayed it in Collins Barracks, and I won't go into it now because I could have finished up in court, but I know what went wrong there, and it's very important that Anne, the one person, has custody and can deal with the relevant top people, and only deal with the top in the museums and libraries, because otherwise things get diluted.
And where is the McCormick collection now?
I think it was sold off, I'm not sure. I know that Donald McNally, the great Donald McNally, the optician, very involved, and he was very sad that it didn't finish up in the National Museum, because, you know, you could see costumes that McCormick had performed in, that he'd actually torn with the strength of his kind of presence on the stage. It was just magic material, and it's, as far as I know, it's not in the National Collection, and that's very sad for me as an ex-director.
So you believe I don't want to put the gavel to the wood at this stage, but you believe it is a very important collection what Anne has?
Of course it is. I mean, the performer you're talking about is a world-class figure and influenced even non-Irish people. So I would, if I were Anne, with due respect, Anne, I would contact Audrey Whitty immediately.
Okay. Stay with us, Pat. Grainne Conroy. Grainne.
Yes.
You actually, hi, Joe. She was in your home, Margaret Burke Sheridan.
That's right. We were living in Dublin at the time, and we would have musical soirees every couple of weeks or so.
Okay.
And on one of these occasions, the pianist brought Margaret Burke Sheridan into our home. and I heard her actually singing "O mia bambino caro," the Puccini aria, "O oh, my beloved father" in English. And I was standing right beside her, and I said to her, "Oh, you should be singing in opera." I was just a teenager; I didn't know anything about it myself. And but a great kind of sadness came over her face when I said that. And but I did hear her sing the that aria. And, looking
what stage,
back now,
what stage of her career was he was she at then?
This is towards the end of her life, I think.
Oh, the end of her life.
In her fifties, in the fifties, and she. But I went on to train myself in New York with Nurse Bieber, or with from the Metropolitan Opera.
Yeah.
So I got an understanding of what technique is the bel canto technique, and I can now look in retrospect. I can see where Margaret's training wasn't complete, so that when the voice.
Okay.
When she had medical or emotional things, the voice dropped. So when I heard her singing the aria "O mio bambino caro," it was almost like a mezzo singing it. She, but she was singing with a tremendous gusto and passion. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And did you refer to that? Did you see sadness or hear sadness in her voice?
When I said to her after she finished singing the aria, I was just standing beside her in our drawing room in Dublin, and I where the piano was, and I said to her, "Oh, you should be singing in opera." I knew nothing about her,
didn't know who
she was really.
And little did you know she had sang on the stage of every
I didn't
every
know anything about her, but
famous
she said
opera
to me,
house. Yeah,
I didn't know that because I was just. My parents would have known that, but
she
was just another artist who came to our home. And so when I said those words, there was a great sadness came over her face. I still remember that.
What a remarkable image,
yes,
Grania.
That's a great memory that I have.
Yeah, it really is. And thank you for sharing
I also, later on then in New York, I met Countess McCormick. She came to the opera, Manhattan Opera Theatre.
And you studied opera as well. Let me just ask Anne Chambers before we finish. Anne, first of all, you knew you have a remarkable collection.
Well, you know, Joe, I have actually exhibited. You know,
great.
I exhibited myself for three weeks in Fitzwilliam Square. I did it in Castlebar on three separate occasions. And myself and a few friends like Siobhan Kilkelly in Castlebar, we hope now in this year for her 135th anniversary, when the National Concert Hall doesn't seem to be doing anything, we again will hold another concert. We're not concert promoters, but for Sheridan we do it, you know.
And
so this collection also includes, of course, my own collection that I've collected over the years on Sheridan. And I certainly will be entrusting them down the road to an appropriate place.
Okay, well done, Anne. Well done. And Godspeed all your work, as Pat Wallace referred to so graciously there. It's fantastic. Pat Wallace, Stephen Crowther, thank you as well. And Anne Chambers. As well, thank you so much. And Grania Conroy on sound, Dave Gibson, researcher John Riley, Richie Byrne, producer Tara Lockery Grant, and Ray Darcy's next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.